Chairman Moi is not with us quite yet, but she should be here any minute. And in the meantime, we're going to continue with where we left off yesterday. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that Ms. Pontius might go through, I think she put it in a committee engrossed version of what we did last night, and I think we need one or two places of that, and then I know that there are some other amendments. I know Senator Higgins has one, and I will be offering another as well, at least.
So are you wanting to offer an amendment at this time?
No, Madam Chair. I think I'd have Ms. Pontius tell us what members are looking at.
CE1.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members. Yeah, it's numbered wrong on top. It says 2901 CE1. I think that it should be 2912, but regardless,
this is the right one.
Right, and so it reflects all the amendments that were adopted last night in a clean document.
And are there other copies? I think so.
That's what we worked on yesterday?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, does Ms. Pontius want to...
Ms. Pontius, do you want to walk us through the changes
Madam
that
Chair
were made?
And members, basically it incorporates, you had an A1 and an A2 last night. One was a technical amendment, and then there was also the amendment that took the opt-out option out of the bill. I did draft another little amendment. We found another sentence there.
For the opt-out, Madam Chair,
that didn't quite
regarding
work.
The opt-out
right.
piece.
I don't know if you want to consider that now.
I would like to do that. Okay. This would be a good time to do this. So we don't have to walk through, but the members know that they have the engrossed version, and we can work from here. And then, Madam Chair, if I may ask Ms. Pontius, if the other amendments, I assume, are drafted to the engrossed version.
Madam Chair, everything now is drafted to the engrossment.
All right. So. Madam Chair, may I now... give my profound thanks to Ms. Pontius.
Yes, you may.
And I do.
All right.
I think we... Do we have a quorum?
Yeah.
Okay, a quorum is present.
Well, don't we? One, two, three, four, five, six.
Oh, yeah. Have that amendment.
Oh, thank you. Oh,
she doesn't have it.
Did someone
get it shortly? Yeah. Technical one on the opt-out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here.
She doesn't have one.
She needs it.
Senator Higgins, thank you, dear. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, then, this has to do with when we took the opt-out language out of the bill, and that was tricky because it was interwoven. This would be on page 5, then on the engrossed version, line 10, where it says we want your permission to allow.
We've given you contact information to.
Or contact information to.
Yeah, that's good.
And then line 21, instead of saying you can also contact them instead, we will say directly. And then on the same page.
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, Senators, those are just a couple of cross-reference that I in the original bill that I found were to the wrong subdivision. So.
Okay.
Members, do you have any questions? Okay. Senator Scheid moves the A10 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Chair.
And then, Senator Scheid, are you ready for my amendment?
Okay. That's the
yes, A6. That would be fine.
Madam Chair, I'll offer the A5 amendment. It's the same language.
She said A5. It's just drafted to the engrossment instead of the original.
Okay, Ms. Pontius, could you perhaps explain to us, Senator Scheid Senator Higgins is offering the A5 amendment. I have an A6 amendment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, actually the A6 is just drafted to the engrossment instead of, it's really identical.
Okay, fine.
So either
we
either
have
one
a copy
works.
Of that? Yeah. And I just haven't found it. Okay.
This is all for every bill we've had on the agenda.
Okay. Senator Higgins, on your amendment?
Madam Chair, This is a section of statute where when people go to register their deeds or their contracts for deed, they must provide a name and an address for the tax statements to go to. And you know that I in my other job I work in city government and work with boarded and vacant and condemned properties. And one of the things that happens is that when the county sets up its property information database, the taxpayer name and address is set up from this information, where the tax statement goes to, the owner and the address. What happens in way too many cases of properties that are not owner-occupied is that the owner will put his or her name and then the property address, not where he actually lives or his business address. So what happens for us in a very practical way when we're trying to, at the city, contact people who have houses that are in need of notices sent to them because of, an intent to condemn the property or an intent to assess the property for something that's gone on, is we send a notice to the person and it goes to this taxpayer information address. Well, what happens when a property is boarded is that it comes back and we don't actually get to give the person the real notice that they should get. And in the cases of, somebody's broken into your house and you really should go, fix the busted up door that we boarded for you or the police boarded for you, or, you have serious hazards and things that will cause this property to be condemned unless you go deal with them, we often can't find the owner because he hasn't given the information to the county and then in turn to the city. So what this amendment does is just merely say that this, when they fill out this piece of information, they have to give their real name and either their residential or business address. So, Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, that's all that is. And I'd like your support for that. And I actually printed out, Madam Chair, a page off of the property info sheet from the city this morning for a property just around the corner from my house, and so that's why I grabbed it. But here's the taxpayer information. It's the person's name and the address, the house around the corner from my house. Well, it's been condemned because it's boarded. It's been condemned because it has no utilities. But all the information would go to the owner, in theory, at that address, although I know he lives in Bloomington. So that's the problem, and I hope that you support this amendment.
Madam Chair? Senator Olson. Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I don't work in this area, so I totally take your word for it, and I can understand where this would be a problem. The only question I have, without working in this area, and maybe Mr. Dunleavy or someone else would have something to offer too, is there a reason to have both addresses? I mean, is there any purpose served by having the address of the property as well as the mailing address of the person who's
on the form?
Would there be any need or reason to have both addresses?
Well, I believe Madam Chair, I believe that there is. I mean, because they're filing the paperwork for that, for instance, that property around the corner from my house, and it would be filing either the deed or the contract for deed for it. It's one of many pieces of paper that they file, and so it would have the property address. What we need is the owner's address.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I understood Senator Olson's question, is I think you do need to tie the owner and their current address, their actual address, which Senator Higgins' language does, to the address of the property they own.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, when a contract for deed or a deed is being given, This might make sense in the case of somebody who owns multiple properties, and the person lives in Bloomington is buying a bunch of properties in Minneapolis, and you want to be able to know that the owner, where the owner really lives and not the property address. But if it's just somebody who is just buying a home that they intend to live in, that's probably the address they're going to put on the contract for deed or for the tax statements. And if they realize that they're in debt up to their eyeballs, can't pay the mortgage, and want to walk away from them, this will certainly not solve that problem, which I think is probably in many situations. Because the deed gets recorded at the front end, and then when the whole thing turns sour and they leave, that's still going to be where the tax statement says to go to, and you have no idea where people go after they walk away from it. So this certainly is not going to solve, many of the problems that might be out there for this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dannon just informed me that, it's a rough number, I suppose, but about 50% of the properties that are in foreclosure in the city of Minneapolis are investor-owned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they can't find
the
investor.
The investor. And, in fact, Madam Chair, I believe in my neck of the woods in North Minneapolis, it's closer to 70 or 75%. Mm-hmm.
So, Senator Scheid, you're open to the A6 amendment?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anybody that is opposed to it.
Senator Scheid and Senator Higgins, Ms. Pontius has a technical correction for your consideration. Ms. Pontius.
Oh, Madam Chair, members, I just noticed there's also form language that's on lines 10 to 12. It would probably make sense to have the form reflect this so that on line 12, after name, insert, or before name, insert legal, and after name, insert of grantee. And then before address, insert residential or business. So it's right. Otherwise, they'll get this form, and you still might have a lot of people not complying with the law.
Oh, good change. Thank you. Yeah, I will.
You want to incorporate that into the amendment?
Yep, please.
All right. Any further discussions on the A6 amendment? Anybody want to comment on it from the audience?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, I just thought after listening to Senate counsel that deeds will get recorded at some time in the future, and we don't want to make them, not comply with this law. So there should probably be some type of a savings provision that says, any deed recorded or dated or signed after this date has to comply with this. And maybe August 1 would be a logical date. Any deed executed after August 1.
Madam Chair, Mr. President, or if we said
Ms. Pontius,
this you can kind of put little sort of effective date or application, the way the revisor does those little things after the ends of sections now, and it would just say this section applies to. I don't know if you would want to just say a contract for deed or a deed conveying fee title to real estate recorded or registered on or after August 1, 2008.
Ms. Pontius, why don't you take a couple minutes and write that down, and then maybe we can have. Mr. Dunleavy, do you have anything that's, what's your reaction to what Ms. Pontius has just suggested?
Madam Chair, could Senate Counsel read that again, please?
Madam Chair, members, it would basically be an effective date or section after line 14, which would say that this section applies to a contract for deed or deed conveying fee title to real estate recorded or registered on or after August 1, 2008.
No, it should be executed.
Executed?
Because it could be signed months before, and then it would be invalid if it was recorded late.
So executed on it. Okay.
We're going to give Ms. Pontius a couple of minutes to just write that down so that we make sure that we get the correct language. Senator Olson?
Well,
Well, Ms. Pontius is doing that, just so I understand, to follow up on that question I had earlier. I know that the front of a deed, and again, I haven't worked in this area for many years, but the front of a deed generally has the legal description, which is not easily translated to the address of the property. And the back, where you have where the tax statements go, which is, I think, what we're changing here, is what says, you know, that that's usually the only place where there's the address of the property on that particular document. So by not having the address of the property on that deed document, does that potentially create any issues or problems? Is it enough that it's going to be located on other documents that would be filed, or don't you see any problem with that?
Mr. Dunleavy?
Madam Chair, presently the address requirement is for the convenience of the county auditor for preparing tax statements, and that's a statutory requirement for all deeds and mortgages. When the auditor gets the deed, they transfer the title on their records, and those are only tax records. They're not official legal title records. And then they use the address that's in the deed for the future tax statements. Real estate is going to continue to be described by legal description forever, because that's the only way that you can locate it on the ground. Street addresses are notoriously inaccurate, and I think you may remember a quote by our distinguished former governor about addresses in St. Paul. And that's true. I mean, addresses do not describe the property. They're only for the convenience of people that are trying to send letters or locate the property on the ground or the building. But the legal description is what governs who actually owns the real estate. That won't change.
Council has the new language. I'm going to invite Ms. Pontius to read that, and then I believe maybe we should make that an amendment to the amendment. So, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, it would be after line 14, insert brackets, effective date, and then a sentence. This section applies to a contract for deed or deed conveying fee title to real estate executed on or after August 1, 2008.
Mr. Dunleavy?
Could you read it again, please?
Ms. Pontius.
This section applies to a contract for deed or deed conveying fee title to real estate executed on or after August 1, 2008.
I think that works.
Senator Hagan, Senator Betzel.
Just conveying fee title to real estate, does the term to real estate, is that redundant? Because what do you convey fee title to if not to real estate? I'm just curious.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Best, I was just copying the current law on line 6 and 7.
So. Never mind. Okay.
Senator Higgins, do you want to make that an amendment to the amendment?
Sure.
Or do you want to incorporate that? An amendment to the amendment?
Madam Chair, however you want to do it, it's fine by me. I had my coffee this morning.
Senator Higgins moved to amend the A6 amendment as in the form of the language as read by council. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now on the A6 amendment, any discussions? Any further discussions? All those in favor of the A6 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any other amendments?
Madam Chair, I was going to offer a couple of amendments. The Minnesota Association of Realtors had some concerns about allowable costs and some they do with homeowners to try to keep them from going into foreclosure, but I think they're still conferring with Mr. Elwood, and I expect Mr. Dunleavy, Ms. Dannon might be involved in those conversations. So those, I think, would not be inappropriately discussed in the Commerce Committee. But if you want to see them after, I mean, we're not ready at this moment. We just haven't reached full agreement.
Senator Shah, you're giving the committee, the Judiciary Committee, a heads up that there might be a couple of amendments coming through to the Commerce Committee that's in the works.
Madam Chair, since I sit next to the chairman of this committee on the floor of the Senate, I would not want to surprise her in any way. There are no good surprises, so I just wanted to alert you, yes.
And Senator Shah, those amendments would be the substance of those amendments you anticipate would be within the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee.
Madam Chair, they deal with 580. I should look. I'm assuming. Anyway, they deal with foreclosure process and allowable costs. It's real estate related, and the services they provide having to do with people who are real estate brokers giving price opinions and licensed, and appraisers for appraisals, and we want to be sure that they're licensed, but that we may have to work with that. Did you want to wait, Madam Chair, until through the committee, and maybe they can work out some language and we'll keep the bill here?
Senator Shai, do you think, can that be done? We're going to be here for a little while. Do you think that language can be worked out? All right. Well, then, let's... Senator Parasol.
Just in case this bill walks away before I get to ask a question, either to the chair or to the author and Mr. Dunleavy, does this bill deal with anything other than residential foreclosures? I have some constituents with farms who are possibly facing foreclosure, and I'm not sure whether this will address their concerns and is it available to them or if not.
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, this would affect all foreclosures by advertisement and by action. The notice provisions deal with residential property. So if it was a commercial property, it wouldn't necessarily apply to that. Most commercial properties are foreclosed judicially. And farm foreclosures, there's a mediation process that's required before commencement of a foreclosure. I don't have a lot of experience with farm foreclosures, but there's a fairly high probability that they would also be judicial foreclosures because there would be other types of collateral involved besides the real estate.
Madam Chair, I ask because some of them have multiple dynamics, including the fact that you've got a 1 in 40 ordinance in some townships and not others, and the farms are not parcelable, if that's the right word. I don't know if that is even a word, but you understand what I mean. But they can't sell anything off to make ends meet and keep the remaining land in the home. So that is kind of tough on them. That's why I'm wondering whether the services available to these people are also available to the others.
Mr. Dunleavy?
Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, with agricultural foreclosures, there is the opportunity for the farm debtor to split the property up to remove the homestead from the agricultural land so that that can be redeemed separately so that they could keep the homestead. I think that the residential foreclosure provisions that are given, that are helping, intended to help the borrowers in this legislation would help the farmers in that situation where they've separated the farm homestead from the agricultural land.
All right, thank you.
Senator Shai, we're going to lay the bill on the table and have you all go to the back of the room and see if we can figure this out. I think that we should try to see if we can get the amendments worked out so we can have a chance for the committee members to have a chance to look at it.
Madam Chair, I would just refer because I don't think that the language they're working on would impact Mr. Johnson and Mr. Skillbred. I think that they've asked to speak, but they do not need to speak. I think I'm going to speak for them and say that they have no objection to this bill, and they worked in developing some of this language and I appreciate their help.
For the record, Mr. Johnson has blessed us from the back of the room. Thank you. We'll come back to the bill
once
we get the message to the amendments on the way. excuse me. No, I understand that on 2918 we have a witness who has to be somewhere today. Is that correct, Senator Higgins?
Well, everybody's got to be somewhere.
Yeah, I believe Mr. Dunleavy has to go.
Okay. So why don't we take a – I'm sorry. We're going to go out of order on this bill because I want to make sure that we can accommodate Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's the only one we can find.
Okay,
so we're making
quickly
more.
Then, because that's the only piece we're really going to talk about.
Okay.
Madam Chair, 2918 was a bill that was to encourage the use of the 5-week
redemption period. 5-week redemptions can be used in 3 circumstances, if I understand correctly. If the land is under a certain number of acres, not agricultural land, and if the property is abandoned. And unfortunately, the 5-week redemption period isn't used as often, especially in the abandoned properties, as pretty much everybody who's working with these properties in local government would really need. And I have a couple of handouts to show you. One is just from yesterday or the day before is Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul's plan for empty houses. And in here they talked with Jim Urkel, who's the head of the Dayton's Bluff Neighborhood Housing Services, and talking about how the 5-week redemption period is just, could be a good tool, because waiting 6 months when a property is abandoned is 6 months too long for the community that's looking at a vacant house where nobody is shoveling the snow or mowing the lawn or pulling the weeds or, it's staying as an attractive nuisance for people who want to get in, and kids have parties in these abandoned properties. Drug dealers go and use them for nefarious reasons. And as, we worked on last year, people go in and steal the copper and anything else that's got any bit of value and strip the houses from their architectural value, making it really difficult for the next person to come in. You'll see fireplaces having been stolen, pocket doors, all those kinds of things. Anyway, so when I actually was looking at the bill as introduced yesterday, I realized it really didn't do anything that I wanted it to do. So I called Mr. Dunleavy and said, could you help me out? And so he drafted some language, which is getting copied, that would make it easier for the use of the 5-week redemption period. And so I will turn it over to him, and he can then tell you kind of what problems people go through trying to use that.
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, this legislation was passed, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago by the legislature, and maybe it was longer than that, but the public policy that the legislature was addressing was, at that time, what the legislature considered to be an epidemic of crack use in some of the urban neighborhoods, and I don't know if that's still an epidemic now or not, but that was the specific concern that was on the mind of the legislature. This is a judicial process, so there is somebody in a black robe that's available to make sure that there is due process and that the homeowner isn't losing the property when they're, for example, a snowbird down in Arizona or Florida, that the property actually is abandoned. The problem that I've been hearing from the attorneys that do a lot of these foreclosures is that in some counties it's extremely difficult to get the courts to grant the 5-week redemption period. They're concerned perhaps more about the ownership interest of the property owner versus the public policy of getting these properties back into the stream of commerce and preventing them from becoming what used to be crack houses, or now it's whatever they turn into. The legislature clearly has the authority to do this with its police powers to regulate and to get the properties, to keep them from becoming attractive nuisances, to keep them from becoming detrimental to the community, to the health and to the safety of the community. So anyway, the language that I came up with is more explicitly the legislature ordering the court to grant the 5-week redemption periods if the evidence that's before the court supports the 5-week redemption. What I'm hearing is that some judges actually go beyond what's in the record in the court file and do independent investigations, which, you know, might be appropriate in some circumstances, but perhaps not in this case. And then the other one is, and this is probably the black and white one. My view is that if there's good service and the debtor doesn't show up at the hearing, what else do you need? That should be enough. That should be conclusive evidence that the property is abandoned. And so that's what this proposal states.
Mr. Dunleavy, can you set the context for us? I mean, I'm kind of new to this area, and I'm a little bit confused about what the current practice is, and then what the proposal is going to do to change the current practice. So can you back up a little bit and set up the context for us?
Okay. There's two circumstances under which 582.032 would be used. One is before the sheriff's sale, and then the other is after the sheriff's sale. Typically what happens is the creditor, the foreclosing attorney, has to serve the notice of the sheriff's sale on the occupant of the property. That's usually the first indication that the foreclosing attorney would have that the property is vacant or abandoned. So the creditor's attorney serves the notice of sale, and the sheriff or the process server returns an affidavit saying the property is vacant. At that point, then, the creditor has the legal right under 582.031 to winterize and secure the property, just based on that affidavit of vacancy. And that's good public policy for everybody, because a frozen house is, what I understand, is worse than a house that's had a fire. It's not good for the community. It's not good for the debtor. It's not good for the creditor if the property freezes up or if it's not secure and people break in and trash the place. Okay, then at that point, the foreclosing attorney would investigate to determine whether the factors under 582.032 are available, and they're listed in the statute. I don't know if you got the complete statute. Okay, let me see if I can find it here quickly. Okay, here are the factors. In subdivision 7, following is prima facie evidence of abandonment. Windows or entrances to the premises are boarded up or closed off, or multiple window panes are broken or unrepaired. 2, doors to the premises are smashed through, broken off, unhinged, or continuously unlocked. 3, gas, electric, or water services to the premises are terminated. 4, rubbish, trash, debris have accumulated on the mortgage premises. 5, the police or sheriff's office has received at least 2 reports of trespassers on the premises, or of vandalism or other illegal acts being committed on the premises. Or 6, the premises are deteriorating or are below or in imminent danger of falling below minimum community standards for public safety and sanitation. That one's a little bit mushy, but the other ones are pretty black and white as far as you can find out from the sheriff, you can find out from the electric company, you can view the property to determine are the doors smashed in. So if those factors are evident, then either the sheriff or the creditor can sign an affidavit to that effect. Then that's the basis for getting the 5-week redemption period. If it's before the sheriff's sale, it's by summons and complaint, and it has to be served like a summons and complaint in a civil action, so it's either going to be personal service or publication. If it's after the sheriff's sale, it's by order to show cause. The order to show cause has to be personally served or published.
So what the amendment does is that it's different from the bill, because the amendment still keeps in place those factors.
That's correct.
But you are now go to the new language in the A1 amendment.
Okay. The language is, the purpose of this language is for the legislature telling the judiciary, we want these properties to be put into the 5-week process because we don't want them to be abandoned. We don't want them to be derelict and a nuisance. And so it's essentially taking away some of the discretion of the judiciary to not grant the 5-week redemption periods. Now, as a practical matter, if anybody appears at the hearing and says, I haven't abandoned this property, there's no judge that's going to give a five-week redemption period. And that's my experience with this. And I think everybody, all the attorneys in practice know that. So that's why this says, if they don't show up, it's abandoned. And that's to make it explicit to the court.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I think that I agree that if there's been proper service and the person doesn't show up without good cause, I mean, if they were getting a car accident on the way to court or something like that, there's always remedies, I think, and I hope, that can take care of this. I do get kind of nervous whenever we have legislation that's gone wrong with us in the past, where we try to tell the court how to weigh its own evidence. I mean, you know, the rules of evidence, everything is there. And when we tell the court, you may not investigate beyond affidavits and so forth, tell them, you know, this is as far as you can go and no further. Boy, I don't like that. I think that we're, you know, who is the legislature to tell a judge how to decide a case? Why don't we just tell them, okay, that you're going to rule this way on every case? So that first
Senator
sentence
Betzel,
bothers me.
Is interested in moving to strike the first sentence of the new language.
I so move, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins and Mr. Dunleavy, any reaction to that? I, too, have to echo Senator Betzel's concerns about separation of powers and our ability to instruct the courts to do something. I think the most important piece about this new language is the black or white, the defendant's failure to appear at the hearing is, you know, the absolute evidence that they've abandoned the property. And I am a little bit nervous about that first sentence. Mr. Dunleavy?
Senator Moore and Senator Betzold, the problem here is the statute does say it's prima facie evidence. That in itself should be enough for the courts to say, okay, you've shown me enough evidence. The circumstances where they investigate beyond, I can understand what you're saying. I think that under this, the court still has the discretion to evaluate the evidence that they're presented. What the circumstances where it's a problem is they're going on the internet doing investigation beyond what's in the pleadings and what's the prima facie evidence. So they're kind of ignoring the prima facie standard. Your comment about what happens if it's done by mistake, you're right, there is a procedure. I think there's a procedure to vacate a judgment, and it would be for excusable neglect. So if there was a situation where there was service and they got into a car accident, that would probably be excusable neglect, and they'd be able to undo this.
Senator Higgins, any thoughts on Senator Betzel's motion?
Madam Chair, I'm once again, I'll say I'm not the lawyer in this group, and so anything I would say would be irrelevant anyway.
Okay. Any discussions on Senator Betzel's amendment to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Now, on the A1 amendment, this A1 amendment basically is a delete all, Senator Higgins, to the language of the bill.
No. To make a new section.
Oh, sorry.
What I really wanted was a delete all.
Oh, keeping the publication language.
Sorry.
Yes.
Very good. Madam Chair, I actually went into somebody's office and grabbed the public notices on St. Paul Legal Ledger, and it seems to me that every one of these already has the language at the end of the notice about the possible use of the five-week redemption period. So I don't know that that's necessary at all. What the last sentence of the original language did would be to say that the last publication of the notice would say specifically whether they would go to the five-week redemption period or not. And frankly, you know, when they send notices to the newspaper, they say, here's the notice, publish it these 6 days. And so I don't think I like that anyway. So I would prefer it if it was just a delete all. So Pontius can explain those. Okay. I think it's changing 1.2 to delete everything after the initial search and then change section 2 to section 1.
So, Ms. Pontius, can you give us the language to amend the A1 amendment to make it a delete all?
Madam Chair, members, I think you just incorporate the concept, just delete section 1 and insert this as section 1. So instead of saying page 1 line after line 19, insert, just say page 1, delete section 1, and insert section 1, which would be the amendment language.
Okay.
So, Ms. Pontius, read that again.
Madam Chair, on the amendment, all you do is say page 1, delete section 1, and insert in lieu of what's there. And then just on line 3, it'll now be section 1 instead of section 2.
Very good. Senator Higgins moves that amendment to the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, to my right here is Sherry Pemberton, who is a really important person in St. Paul government because she works with these houses every day. She was also part of the task force on vacancies that worked all fall and winter. And I would like her to testify on this as well.
Well, Ms. Pemberton, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sherry Pemberton with the City of St. Paul. I work with the Planning and Economic Development Department. We look at this bill as a very important part to our local bankers who have stayed and taken an interest in our neighborhoods and that this is a process that they can use. It's also a process for our nonprofit agencies that have loaned money on some of the houses that are in foreclosure and vacant and abandoned. I think I haven't talked with Mr. Dunleavy about this, but I think it also helps us where the first mortgage lender has sort of abandoned the property and is not taking an interest in the property. When we have second and third mortgages on them, we can use this to expedite foreclosures.
Very good. Thank you. Any further discussions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none. Anybody in the audience would like to testify on the A1 amendment? Senator Higgins moved that for adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Since the A1 amendment is now Senate File 2918 and nobody wanted to testify on the A1 amendment, I'm assuming that nobody wants to testify on Senate File 2918 from the audience. Very good. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2918 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, do you want me to continue on, or do we have other...
Senator Scheid, are you ready to go back to your bill?
No.
Senator Scheid is ready. So the two of you will be playing musical chair. Back and forth.
The two Lindas, that's right.
The two Lindas, that's right.
Here we actually have a Lindas caucus. Some caucus, maybe. Madam Chair, I...
Senator Scheid, for the record, we are now back on Senate File
2912, Madam Chair. And I would offer then only one of those real estate-related or realtor-related amendments, the A7.
A7. Do we have that?
I got it.
Yeah. Oh. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think it relates.
Did we actually get an agenda for today?
It has to do with redemption and what are allowable costs.
Yeah.
So it's on page 16 of the bill. I would ask Ms. Diori from the Association of Realtors to explain what happens in a transaction or in a situation and why they think they should be able to be paid.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Diori, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Oftentimes, when there's a foreclosure, it's frequent for the lenders to contact a real estate licensee in order to make a determination as to whether or not there could potentially be, if there's a short sale request, they often need to understand what the market value is going to be, or if there is going to be redemption, the potential if there wasn't going to be a redemption, what their potential is for reselling that in the marketplace. So the point is, a lot of oftentimes during this particular time period, the lender's not understanding or needs to know essentially what their position is as far as the value of that property. And so we're just requesting here that a broker price opinion be able to be redeemed obtained upon redemption.
And Senator Shai, do we know in the industry what that kind of amount is, or what the parameters of that amount is?
Madam Chair, I don't know what charges usually are.
Ms. Dewar.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it ranges. Obviously, it's probably around $100 to $200 mark.
And that's the industry practice,
exactly.
Right? That's
yep.
Industry practice. Any discussions on the Senator Scheid moves the A7 amendment?
Madam Chair, I do.
Any discussions on the A7 amendment? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails.
Then, Madam Chair, I think this note in red ink is probably from Ms. Pontius. It was on my chair. And it was an amendment dealing with a concern that Senator Ortman, oh, and there she is, had concerning the reinstatement process and notice. And I wonder, I don't know if Senator Ortman has seen the amendment. It's the A9.
Regina?
Senator,
we have it here.
Ortman, there's an engrossed bill somewhere there.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's going to say 2901 CE1, even though it's 2912. Okay. And this amendment is the A9.
Why don't we have Ms. Pontius walk us through the A9 amendment and let Senator Ortman catch her breath. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, this is in the on page 15 of the bill. This is the provision that you had some discussion on last night where the sheriff can request the payoff amount, and if it's not received within a certain period of time, they postpone the sheriff's sale. And basically what this would do would kind of eliminate this kind of automatic continuous 7-day rollover of the postponement of the sheriff's sale. So just in cases where the person didn't respond to the request within 7 days, then the sheriff would just postpone the sale and announce this was the postponement at the sale. And then the requirement that the sheriff keep, you know, having sales and announcing additional postponements is eliminated.
So you want to walk us through the amendment physically? Just so that we...
Madam Chair, the amendment basically just takes out the language consistent with what I just described.
Okay.
So if you look on page 15, line 15, you'll still retain the if there. And then, so it'll just read, if the holder of the mortgage or the holder's legal representative fails to respond within 7 days of the date of the request, and then the sheriff shall postpone the sale and then delete the 7 days. And the sheriff shall, and then... and we'll just read, and announce at the sheriff's sale the postponement announced the postponement at the sheriff's sale rather than a postponement of 7 days.
And that's it? Senator Scheid.
I don't know if Council said it, everything then, the rest of line 19, 20, 21, and the end of the sentence on 22 would be deleted as well. Right.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so you don't keep having this sort of rolling over 7 day.
So, Ms. Pani, starting at the if that stays in place at line 15.15, read to us all the way up to line 22 how it would read.
Well, Madam Chair, if you give me a minute, I don't have my marked up copy of the bill with me, so I'm marking it up myself.
Madam Chair, I've been engrossed.
Senator Betzel.
On page 15, line 15, I believe it would read, if, and then you drop down line 16, the holder of the mortgage or the mortgage legal representative continue the rest of the line 7 days after the date of the request, the sheriff shall postpone the sheriff's sale, and then skip over to, and the sheriff shall announce at the sheriff's sale the date, a postponement before the sale is conducted. Not the postponement.
Chair, I have. Are you looking for someone to read this?
Yeah. I just want on the record and for everyone in the audience and all of us here to know exactly what we're doing. Senator Scheid.
Sure, I believe it. I'll read starting on line 15. If the holder of the mortgage or the holder's legal representative fails to respond to the sheriff's request within 7 days of the date of the request, the sheriff shall postpone the sheriff's sale, and the sheriff shall announce at the sheriff's sale the postponement of the sale. Then you strike the remaining sentence. Language, the next sentence at the end of line 19. 21, and the words before the sale is conducted, period, on 22. You just strike that whole next sentence then.
And then on 22, we pick up again, the postponement does not need to be published.
Right. Chair,
is that clear? Senator Orman?
Thank you, Madam Chair, but that next sentence was my concern, and maybe you want to vote on that amendment first, but the postponement does not need to be published was one of my concerns.
All right, so the A9 amendment, let's vote on the A9 amendment. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, some people worked on this to
respond to Senator Orman's concern, Senator Orman is saying that that's
that fully, so maybe I should withdraw the amendment. I mean, unless she agrees with
this. Senator Orman, this A9 amendment does not take care of your concern?
I agree with the amendment. I guess I can say that, and I have additional concerns as well, but this does improve that section.
Senator Scheid.
I'll move the amendment.
The A9 amendment. Anybody in the audience want to testify on the A9 amendment? Any further discussions on the A9 amendment? All those in favor of the A9 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that language that says the postponement does not need to be published is a problem because we're trying to make sure that these are public sales and we publish a notice so that people in the general public can attend. And I think that it doesn't make sense to publish the first one if we're going to end up with postponements and we don't publish them. So to be consistent, I think we should. I think the person that wants to sell this property should publish the postponement. And so I think that sentence should be removed.
Senator Scheid and
Ms. Dannon.
Ms. Dannon, from a practical standpoint, are we putting undue burden on the sheriff's office, undue expenses on them? Or is it the publication cycle, if we're doing it within 7 days, is it doable to actually do a publication?
Well, and I might give a little background information about sort of what happened. So, and I know we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but when they do these auctions, usually it's just the lender who comes to the auction, maybe it's the homeowner. What we're envisioning here is that the sheriff would just make an announcement at the time that the previously sale time and just saying, hey, we're going to be postponing the sale until, for 7 days. If anyone comes, if the lender's representative comes, sure, they can find out about it then. They probably would know about it before this. You know, publication is, we do publication, and I think, do we have some changes in the, did those, are those in the bill to reduce the weeks of publication?
Yeah, I think
so. Okay. Because when we talked about the current practice of publishing the notice of these, the idea behind it when we created this idea was actually to give the public information so that they could come and they could bid at the sheriff's sale. That doesn't happen because we have the six-month redemption period where you don't really purchase the property at the sheriff's sale. If you wanted to purchase the property, you can buy it from the homeowner. You wouldn't be doing it at this sale. You're getting the sheriff's certificate at this sale. You're not. It's not quite the same thing, which I know is very confusing. I spend a lot of time in my practice explaining that to clients. And so we are... I believe we are actually earlier in the amendments proposing to reduce the number of weeks that on a regular publication we publish. So from 6 weeks, which is the amount of weeks that we do publication, now to 3 weeks. And this is kind of in the same line of that, is actually trying to reduce some of the burden on homeowners of just doing things that we kind of have done for a long time that aren't actually benefiting anyone. I'm sorry that's a long answer, but.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Scheid.
Page 15.
You see, line 9, it deals with postponement. This is earlier in the bill. But that's where we have stricken and continuing the publication. The expense of the party is postponement.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, but in reality...
Oh, yeah.
If the information isn't provided during the postponement period, the first postponement period, the sale will be postponed again, potentially, and again. It's potential because we might not be able to find the lender and find the information. So if somebody in the general public were trying to track this, you would never be able to track it unless you show up for each one of those postponements. And the whole point here is to make it a public sale. And so I think we're defeating our own purpose by saying we're not publishing the postponement. I think it just identifies a bigger issue with this whole thing about the sheriff's office being in the middle and making decisions about when we're going to have a sale and when they're not going to have a sale and whether they should be postponed or not. I think we should look at this provision again, because to say that certain sales will get published and others won't is a problem.
Senator Ortman, do you have an amendment, or do you want to just move to strike that language?
Madam Chair, I would move to strike that sentence. I think that it creates bigger problems for the whole section, honestly. But
you move to strike in line 15.22 the sentence, the postponement does not need to be published.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Dunleavy would.
Mr. Dunleavy.
It's a practical impact of that.
Your Honor, the consensus of the bar is that publication of the postponement is a waste of money, that the public purpose, there isn't really any public purpose served by publishing the postponement. A lot of times the publication cycle is such that it's almost impossible to get the publication done in time before the sale that's been postponed occurs. The only people that look at the publication notices are the redemption speculators that I've told you about. The number of people that actually appear at a sheriff's sale besides the creditor is a very minute number. And the way I envision this would happen is that the postponements would be rare, that most creditors would do backflips in order to get the reinstatement figures to the sheriff in time so that the sales wouldn't be postponed. So I guess the other thing is that by deleting this, there's an implication that there has to be a publication, and then you may end up with defective sheriff sales, and I don't think that does anybody any good. Then you have to do it all over again, pay all the publication costs, all the attorney's fees to do it over again.
Very well. I think that we've had a robust discussion on this. Senator Ortman has offered a motion. Let's just vote on her motion. Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I agree with Senator Ortman's wanting to make things as public as possible, but in most of the communities in my district, they have weekly newspapers, and it would be impossible to do this by publication. And then those costs get passed along to the person who may try to redeem later, and so it's an additional cost that makes it harder to for the owner of the property to come back and pay for this. Would it be possible to ask sheriff's departments just to publicly post a notice of postponement? I mean, I'm sure they're not going to withhold this information if someone's asking for it, but would that be an undue burden on the sheriff's department? So that if someone had first seen that this was going to be offered for sale and was interested, that they would have a way of determining the date that it had been postponed to?
Madam Chair, as a question to
Senator
Parasol's comments, do you mean a public posting on the site, on the property site,
Madam Chair,
or somewhere else?
Senator Moi, no, I was just thinking of like a public notice, like where it could be posted by the sheriff, so that someone could see it if they were coming to the sheriff's office. I wasn't thinking of requiring them to go out to the site and post it. I'm trying to think of not creating additional expenses here for the sheriff's department is what I was thinking.
I'm just thinking about how many people go to the sheriff's office each day, unless they're hauled in.
Well, let's vote on Senator Ormond's motion.
At the sheriff's office myself.
Members, let's vote on Senator Ormond's motion, and then we can have, if her motion prevails, then we don't need to continue this discussion. If her motion doesn't prevail, and, you know, I mean, let's vote on that motion, then we can continue the discussion. Is that all right,
Chair,
Senator Ormond?
On the motion, to Senator Olson's point about the postponement does not need to be published, we took out, from what I can tell, the seven-day requirement that the postponement can only be in 7 days. The postponement could be 30 days. It could be 60 days. We took that provision out, so it could still be published. Even if the only newspaper available were a weekly newspaper, I don't think that there's a requirement now in this language that the postponement be for 7 days.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I pulled out my trusty St. Paul legal ledger, and I found one notice of postponement of the sale, and it looks like it is published 4 weeks in a row. So, you know, they published the sale the notice of the sale for 6 weeks. It looks like they published the notice of foreclosure or of postponement for 4 weeks. So, and that's probably overkill. But anyway.
On Senator Ormond's motion to delete from line 15.22 the sentence, the postponement does not need to be published. I think we've had a lot of discussion on this. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any other discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I would move to delete all of subdivision 2 from 580.30, mortgages when reinstated. This is a very complicated requirement.
That's the whole section.
Yep, subdivision 2, the whole request by the sheriff to write the letter and to get the reinstatement amount. It's not current law. It's a good idea, but it's premature because it's extremely complicated. It creates whole new sets of relationships between the borrowers and the lenders and the sheriff. It puts the sheriff in the middle of all these transactions trying to get all the information together before a sale can take place and make a recommendation as to whether the sale is timely or not. And it changes everything. I think it's a good idea, but it's not well thought out yet. And I would hope that this committee would say we could take this up another day, but it doesn't need to go forward in this bill, which is otherwise an excellent bill. I think we could take this section out and move it forward, and I hope that the committee will help me do that. And so, Madam Chair, I move that we remove subdivision 2.
On Senator Ortman's motion, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Dan would like to respond to some of the background of why we want this.
Ms. Dannon, now we've already had testimony for both of you last night on the merits of this. I just got to tell you guys, we have a long agenda. So we're not leaving today until all the bills have been processed. Just want to let you all know that.
I'll be quick.
Love you all. And spend the day together. Senator Ms. Dannon.
I'll be quick. the background of why we created Subdivision 2 is that homeowners working with foreclosure counselors were having a really, really difficult time just getting this information from their lender. And so we looked at different ways to facilitate that, getting that information. And the best way that we could determine to get that information was utilizing the Sheriff's Department, because that's a neutral third party, not the lender, not the foreclosure counselor, not the homeowner, who can act as a neutral third party and get that information.
Anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against this amendment?
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I would like to keep Subdivision 2. I would certainly welcome continuing, you know, to work and collaborate with Senator Ortman, but I want.
And I think Senator Ortman was very eloquent last night on why she opposes this section. So, on Senator Ortman's motion.
Technically, Madam Chair, it's actually deleting Section 19, if I understand. Or, sorry, section 18,
the entire sorry. Section.
The
Senator
entire
Ortman.
Section 18, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't. Yeah, the rest 8. Is current law, but yeah.
Yep. Senator Ortman revises her motion to delete the entire Section 18. Any further discussions from the members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any other discussions?
Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, yes. When we talked about the fact that we want to reduce the costs for the person trying to redeem or reinstate, the bill neglects to have some language in it, and that's no one in this room's fault, I think, other than we didn't catch it when the bill was drafted. But it has to do with the notice of sale. Page 6 of the bill. I'll take you right there. Page 6 of the bill, line 622, says notice of sale service on occupant. We need to change the language so that.
Could you read my
I'm trying
handwriting?
To.
She's got my handwriting up there.
So everything, just delete 6 on line 23, delete 6 weeks. Insert, commencing 6 weeks before the appointed time of sale. A 3 weeks, and then continue. Published notice shall be given.
Senator Shai, can you repeat that, please?
Yes. Line 623 will read with my amendment that I'm offering. Commencing 6 weeks before the appointed time of sale, a 3 weeks, apostrophe after weeks, I guess, and then that would be inserted there instead of 6 weeks.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I think, Senator Scheid, you need to look at this, the clause that starts on 6.24, and at least 4 weeks before the appointed time of sale, such that, which is really written badly to begin with. But I think you worked on the first part of the sentence, but it also needs work on the second part of the sentence.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Dunleavy.
Could I address Senator Higgins' comment?
Please.
The language should read commencing at least 6 weeks before the appointed time of sale, because publication usually starts more than 6 weeks, and by saying firmly that it has to be 6 weeks would probably goof up the timing.
Senator Scheid will incorporate into that suggestion, so it will be commencing at least 6 weeks before the appointed time of sale.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Higgins?
Are you anticipating that it would be published 3 weeks in a row, every other week for 6 weeks, or just 3 weeks starting 6 weeks out? 3 weeks in a row, 6 weeks out.
Senator Chair.
Mr. Dunleavy.
Chapter 645 has provisions that deal with publication, and I believe it it says that it's got to be consecutive weeks.
Okay, Senator Chair, Mr. Dunleavy, so how in practical matter would this work? 6 weeks before the scheduled sale.
Ms. Nana or Mr. Dunleavy, can you walk us through the timetable?
There would have to be 3 weeks worth of publications, but the 3 weeks closest to the scheduled sale
wouldn't have any publications?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the present practice requires 6 weeks publication.
Yes.
And in order to have six successive weeks of good publication, the creditor's attorney would start publication at least 8 weeks before the sheriff's sale, so that if there's a typo in the publication, it can be corrected and then published again. With this amendment, the public policy here is to save the publication costs by cutting the number of weeks of publication in half. And the way I would envision this to work is roughly 8 weeks before the sheriff's sale, the creditor would start publication for three successive weeks. And probably simultaneously with that, send the notice of sale to be served on the occupant. So publication would probably start at the same time as it is now, roughly 8 weeks before the sale. It just wouldn't have those last three publications.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betts, Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a procedural thing. We've been working on this for a considerable period of time, and it strikes me as that this thing is never going to end, and we're looking at something where I think would be better to have the parties work out something between or among themselves and let the rest of us move on to something else.
I think Senator Foley makes a good point on this. Is this the last tweak to this bill? I mean, Senator Scheid?
Chair, it's the last one I have. I agree with Senator Foley. It seems like it will never end. I don't, I think, however, this was inadvertently left out. When one question was raised about notice, Mr. Elwood, I think, realized the advocates couldn't find where we had put this language, and it wasn't in the bill. I'm sorry. It just happened.
All right, Senator Higgins, are you satisfied, or
yep.
do you still have questions?
I'm good.
Are you satisfied
yep.
with this new language? Any other discussions on this language? Any audience members want to testify for or against this new amendment? Discussions from committee members. Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves the addition of the new language, as she stated, to line 6.23 on page 6. Council, do you have that information? Very good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid, do you have a motion?
Chair, I'd like to move that Senate file 2912 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. I don't think there will be much for that committee to do, but I think they should see it.
Now that the bill is complete and we're going to send it off, anybody in the audience want to testify against the whole bill? For the whole bill? Thank you. Members, discussion. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that I really like one of the provisions of this bill that asks the lenders to notify the borrowers about foreclosure prevention counseling and making that immediately available to them. I think that we've got to be careful about how we identify who those foreclosure counselors are, and we may want to do some work on that. But I think overall that is a really great proposal, and it dispenses with some of the concerns that I had with the bill about the data privacy. Because if they're getting the foreclosure counseling through a private referral from their lender, we may not need all the collection of all that information with the sole purpose of getting prevention counseling sooner to these people, because we're actually getting it prior to the collection of all this information from the notice of the sale or the list pendants. So I'm hoping that the committee will think about that as that other bill progresses. I think that was your bill, Senator?
Senator Rest.
I don't remember whose
bill. Senator Rest's bill.
Senator Rest's bill. Thank you.
I just mucked around.
It seems to me that bill, the urgency for that bill and the need for that bill is not as clear, because now we've got a vehicle for getting foreclosure prevention counseling to people that need it even further in advance of that. And so I hope the members will think about that when we have further debate on that data privacy bill.
Very good. Senator Scheid renews her motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. We're going to break for lunch, Senator Olson, in a little bit, like at noon. And then we're all coming back here to finish whatever bills we have left. So. Okay. That's fine. When we come back after lunch at 1 o'clock, it will be in room 112 because...
I don't have this room.
By 2 o'clock.
Somebody else has the room.
We'll come back at 1 o'clock to some room. We'll find the room.
We can't do that. We
have a couple quickie bills.
We have too many bills. No, at noon. So you can just want to let you know.
Okay.
Stay in touch. Senate, let's see.
Okay.
Is Senator Marty here? Senator Olsen?
I haven't seen him either.
Well...
Oh,
oh, Senator Marty is on his way down. Well, maybe in the next hour we'll be done, which will be great. Senator Olsen is here. Let's take Senator Olsen's bill.
Pick up on the one who's here right away.
Senator Olsen, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, it's my pleasure to come before the Judiciary Committee, and I say that with a straight face for now.
We'll make it memorable.
Even if you were grimacing, Senator Olsen, Senator Betzel would say that we are achieving our intent.
Excellent.
Senate File 2909.
Madam Chair, I'm here today with Ron Elwood on Senate File 2909. And Ron and I have worked on a number of bills that relate to energy for when people are facing energy being cut off, whether it's heating or gas. And this bill is relates to energy also on for people that are renters, that if their landlord is not paying rent for the facility, there's an opportunity for them to pay the electric bill and have the power kept on and then also deduct that from their rent. So Ron's going to go into more detail on the bill.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I appreciate Senator Olsen carrying this bill. This is one of many bills that you will be hearing this morning, this afternoon. Well, maybe not this afternoon if we're lucky. And it comes out of one of the five working groups that I know you've heard about, all these mortgage foreclosure working groups, this renter group. The report that I have here details our efforts. Met six times between October and January with a large group of stakeholders, similar to the group that met for the remedies group that was the basis for Senator Scheid's bill that you just heard. And this particular proposal does two primary things. It makes it a lot easier for tenants to pay the utility bills when the landlord doesn't pay, and to allow the tenants to keep the utility, the heat, and the lights on. There is a current statute that it's amending, 504B 215 subdivision 3, which provides for a similar ability for tenants to pay the utility bill and keep the service on. However, there were some problems with that statute. It hasn't been as usable as it could be. It was benefiting really neither the tenants nor the utility companies. And before I just explain very briefly what the bill does, I really want to give a tremendous amount of credit and recognize the efforts of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association and all of the utility companies who worked very closely with tenant advocates to develop this proposal. And they it was an arduous process, but at the end of the day, all of those parties came together with this proposal. It does several things. First of all, on page 1, lines 21-23, it provides clarity about what exactly the tenants need to pay to keep the bill, to keep the service on. So the change makes it very clear that the tenant would only be required to pay the current charges, which is essentially last month's bill, and none of the arrears. And that is clarified even further on page 2, lines 15 and 16, which expressly say that current charges don't include arrears. The tenants have, under this bill, essentially two options. They can pay the current charges and get 1 month's or one billing cycle of service and sort of sort out the situation, if the landlord's coming back in the picture or what. The second option would be limited to dwellings of 4 units or less, and in that case, the tenant would have the option. One tenant in that complex would be able to step forward and say, I want the bill in my name. I'm going to become the customer. And if that's the case, they become a customer just like any new customer moving into the service territory. They sign up, they get the service, and the bill comes at the end of the next month, and they continue to pay it. The other provision of the bill makes it clear that the other tenants have the ability to contribute to those charges and get a receipt of documentation from the utility and provide it to the landlord to say that they're going to deduct that from the rent. And that's simply, that's the whole bill.
Ms. Elwood, technically, if the building is a single-metered building and the one tenant wants to step forward to say, we want to do this, but the other tenants disagree, that one tenant is sort of on the hook for the entire current bill. Is that correct, Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair, that's correct. But, of course, this is voluntary, and if the tenant chooses to do that, I would imagine in that situation the tenant would do that if the entire amount of the rent was sufficient to cover the utility bill, because under this statute, which has been current law, the tenant has the ability to pay that utility and simply deduct the entire amount of the rent, if so, from the rent.
Any questions? Senator Betzel.
I got a technical question. Okay, suppose you have a multi-tenant building that qualifies here, and one tenant does step forward and says, okay, I will be responsible for the bill, and this can only be exercised once every 12 months. What if that tenant then leaves? You know, no other tenant in the building can then exercise this option. Where are they then?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, that provision was installed at the request of the utility and agreed to by everybody to prevent the potential situation where one tenant would step forward, and let's say the 4-unit building. So one tenant steps forward, says, I'm going to be the customer record, fails to pay the bill, and then the next month, tenant two steps forward, does the same thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a balancing provision to ensure that the utilities weren't just continuing providing service where they weren't getting paid for it.
It's still, Madam Chair, Mr. Elwood, it still doesn't, you know, somebody's going to find a way around it, and unfortunately, I think the language here that says you can only do it once every 12 months, ultimately, you know, I don't know that it's going to be workable. I think that this is going to create some problems, but, you know, anyway.
Any other questions from the members? Anybody here in the audience would like to speak either for or against this bill? Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2909 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Just for the record, members, the Utilities Committee, I forget the long name, telecommunication, da da da. Yes, I've checked with Senator Partner Solon's committee, and she says she does not need to see this bill. That's why we are not sending it to her. So, on Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
See, Senator Osteen, it was not that painful. Now you come back and visit us.
Wait till the next
this
bill.
Time. This time.
He's one for
Senator
one Chai. For two.
Madam Chair, it's probably cruel and unusual punishment to have somebody come after my bills. I've noticed.
Marty used to chair this committee.
Senator Marty, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. Senate File 2917, there's basically two things. One, it takes the predatory lending provisions that we've had in the past and applies them to manufactured home loans. And then the second thing it does is it extends the period for repossession with better time, better notice, and a longer time for the notice of default and so on. And I'll just quickly go through the bill and then have Mr. Elwood or Ms. Kaplan do it. Section 1 is simply the same. It's a 5% cap on, you can't have more than your total finance charges be more than 5% of the loan amount. Otherwise, you can't mortgage them. You can't include them in the loan. Second one is just prepayment penalty removal. And then Section 2, the next couple of sections is the repossession sections. We're changing from 30 days to 180 days, the time of notice. Required better notice on pages 2 and 3. Through Section 4, that's the language where we're improving the repossession language. Then the rest of the bill is the predatory language, lending language that we've had elsewhere. I would suggest if Senator Betzel wants to clean up the bill, take out the definition at the bottom of page 4.
There should be an author's amendment somewhere.
There may be an author's amendment up there, I'm told.
Yes. Commissioner means commissioner. Commissioner of Commerce means the Commissioner of Commerce.
See, that makes it really cool.
Flip it out of there.
So let's put the A1 amendment, the author's amendment, on, and then Senator Marty can talk about it as we move.
I'll move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. Put the bill in shape the author desires.
On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, start with Ron Elwood, perhaps.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I just want to give a little context before I turn over to my colleagues to provide more detail on the bill. These ideas came out of the remedies group that Senator Scheid led, and these ideas emerged relatively late in the process. The manufactured homeowners folks were not part of this process. It wasn't contemplated when we started that this would be part of the whole foreclosure deal, but it emerged. And when there was language that was kind of fully baked, as soon as that occurred, we did get the language over to the owners folks, but I think it's fair to say that they haven't had that much time to take a look at it and give us some feedback. But we have started the discussions with them. They've been very receptive to the idea of working through this through these ideas. So I just want to be clear that we have been talking, we will continue to talk, and we are hopeful that we can get to a place where we'll all be satisfied with the proposal. So what I think we just ask this committee is to embrace the basic principles of the bill, which are A, to provide more time for residents to reinstate their manufactured home loans, and B, to provide I think, appropriate protections against predatory lending to manufactured homeowners. We did that last year for mortgagors, and I think it's only appropriate that we do that. The details, I think, we need to work on, but the principle, I think, is sound. So with that, let me turn it over to my colleagues.
Mr. Elwood, are you suggesting that this bill is not ready to move forward because there are disagreements, or are you saying that we should move forward with the recommendations in this bill?
Madam Chair, I think
Senator Marty.
This bill has been requested by Commerce Committee, and I think the issues are like the details, whether the time to reclaim your void repossession, extending the period of time, how long it would be extended. I think there are questions like that. I mean, we'd love the committee to adopt it this way, but the point is the industry, both sides are talking with each other, and they haven't resolved where they haven't come to full agreement yet on that. But we'd love to have the bill move forward. Commerce Committee has requested it too.
Ms. Kaplan?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kaplan, and I am the staff attorney with All Parks Alliance for Change, an organization dedicated to protecting the rights of people who live in manufactured homes across the state of Minnesota. The bill you see before you is important to us for several reasons, and I'm going to take the two sections a little bit separately. First of all, under current state law, if somebody defaults on their manufactured home loan, if they miss a payment, the current time frame under the state law only allows them 30 days to become current on the loan and avoid repossession of the manufactured home. However, manufactured homeowners are homeowners, and it seems to us that to have a scenario where a stick-built homeowner can get, you know, 6 months even after a sheriff's sale to try and save their home, where a manufactured homeowner who, you know, the average manufactured home in Minnesota currently costs $65,000, only has 30 days to save that home, seems fundamentally unfair in light of how important manufactured homes are in the state of Minnesota. Currently, as of the last census, approximately one out of every 20 people in the state of Minnesota lived in a manufactured home. So this is an issue that has a wide-ranging scope. It's also a valuable source of affordable housing. However, with only a 30-day reinstatement period, it doesn't allow people who are facing hard economic circumstances to line up adequate resources to save their homes. Some studies have been done related to mortgage foreclosures that find that unless people are given a time period to line up resources, and I believe they said at least 90 days, it severely decreases the ability of folks to come up with resources. So that's why we would ask that the time frame be changed from 30 days to what we propose is 180 days. This is something that we do need to work out with the industry. However, I believe in light of our past negotiations with them on other matters last year that we can come up to a resolution that everybody can agree to. And I just want to say anecdotally, we have seen an increasing number of calls come into our office from people who are facing repossession. In fact, just yesterday I got a call from somebody who had a stroke and a heart attack. She's in a pretty much brand new manufactured home, but with the 30-day time frame, she simply doesn't have the ability to line up resources in time. She believes that if she had a longer time frame, she would be able to come up with resources, whether it be from, you know, government agencies, emergency assistance, or simply from family and friends. However, 30 days is simply not enough time to line up those resources. Additionally, the current notice requirements under the state law only state that there would be one notice of default, and that starts the 30-day time frame. However, the contents of the notice don't provide any information about the possibility of there being counseling out there, credit counseling and information that can help people sort of get out of the hole that they've fallen into. And what we would propose is that there be two notices, one at the beginning of the period and then one, I believe we said, after 60 days, and that both of those notices be very explicit in their content and that they include information about access to homeownership counseling. And additionally, well, the other thing that we have in this provision is predatory lending protections. Last year, overwhelmingly, there was approval for protections for people buying homes from predatory lending. However, because manufactured home loans are considered chattel loans, they aren't part of the statutory scheme that includes the predatory lending protections. Predatory lending has been a serious problem in the manufactured housing arena. In fact, Consumers Union did a study back in 2002 that talked about some of the issues related to predatory lending, including falsification of loan applications, falsifying down payment amounts, additional loan fees, higher interest rates at closing than were originally agreed to, and particularly a failure to determine whether somebody can afford the loan that they are indeed applying for. So we would like to see protections created for homeowners that protect them to the same level from predatory lending practices as those for homeowners who happen to live in stick-built homes as opposed to factory-built homes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Marty, do you have someone? Is it Ms. Guernsey?
Yes.
Ms. Guernsey, we've heard from Ms. Elwood and Ms. Kaplan, so if you can fill in the blanks, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Guernsey. I'm Vice President of Programs with the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Many of you probably actually know Chip Halbach, and I'm going to attempt to fill his large shoes here today. I do have, and actually what I'll do is I'll just hand this maybe to Ron to give to the committee in order to keep my comments short. What I am working off of, maybe the last page is not supposed to be in there. It's a one-pager, and really it just provides, it's really the Minnesota Housing Partnership recognizing that manufactured housing is really becoming an important component of affordable housing in Minnesota, particularly in greater Minnesota and the rural environment. We conducted a study that will be forthcoming. What you're seeing here is a highlight or advance of some of those things that have come out of that study. And part of the results of that study really do indicate that site-built housing, owners of manufactured homes have, unlike site-built housing, manufactured homeowners have very limited financing options as well as consumer protections. And I think what's proposed here today is really two really good first steps in starting to address some equity issues between manufactured housing homeowners and site-built homeowners. I think you'll see through this it's broken down demographics, taxation issues, property tax differences between these two types of property owners. And look forward to us in maybe future sessions addressing some of these other areas that can be addressed through policy. But again, today, this bill is a great first step. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Anybody would like to speak on this bill, against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and we appreciate Senator Marty's willingness to work on concerns that we have with the bill. We were not a part of its drafting, and just relay some foundation in terms of the issue. Manufactured homes and the mortgages associated with them were not a part of or are not a part of the sort of the subprime debacle going on right now in the regard that neither Fannie Mae nor Freddie Mac included manufactured homes in those securitization packages that have created so much controversy. In Minnesota, approximately 80 to 85% of all the manufactured homes that are sold in the state are sold as real estate, go on a permanent foundation, a basement, are financed with FHA, VA, or traditional financing. So the issue that the bill addresses is strictly dealing with homes that are financed without real estate, on leased land, if you will. It may be a manufactured home community, or in many cases it may be a farm where you have family members that will purchase a home and essentially lease the land. And the concerns we have with the bill are that it imposes the same formulas for the APR triggers defining what a subprime loan is as that are placed on traditional mortgages. And the loans that we're talking about here are not. The costs of those loans are, for the lenders, are much higher because the paper for those loans are not, if you will, financeable or saleable to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. So essentially the cost of funds are greater. Additionally, the cost to service a mortgage, whether it's a manufactured home loan for $30,000 in a manufactured home park, or if you have a $150,000 mortgage, the cost to originate the loan are approximately the same, which is about, I understand, $2,500. And the cost to service the loan is relatively the same. So those costs don't change, but what happens is that because it's a lower balance loan, and then you apply those costs to the $30,000 as compared to the $150,000, it essentially, from the get-go, raises the threshold, if you will, of making the loan appear to be a subprime. And we're not only talking about new home sales here, we're really talking in the bigger picture about existing homes in manufactured home parks. There are, we know for sure there are 50,000 licensed manufactured home sites in the state and manufactured home communities, and probably double that in terms of homes on leased land in rural Minnesota. And for the homeowners that would want to sell an existing home in a manufactured home community, what we believe will happen with the bill as drafted is you will simply price out or put people in a situation where because of the value of the home, that loan is defined as subprime, and the potential buyer for that home won't be able to obtain the financing, which means that the existing owner is not going to be able to sell the home, and it would essentially end up sort of feeding the cycle that we're trying to address. So we do have concerns. We appreciate the opportunity to continue to work on the bill and try to improve it. And in terms of technical issues or how the loan process work, I do have one of my members with me, Tony Wickey, who works for a bank, who's in a much better position than I am if there are any questions to talk about APR triggers and those kind of things. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Is it Mr. Brumer?
Bruner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R.
And then Mr. Wickey, welcome to the committee. Can you spell your last name?
W-I-C-K-E.
Very good. Please, if you have comments or statement that you want to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee. As indicated here by Mark previous to this, I'm not really sure that this bill was written with full comprehension of what is happening today in the secondary market regarding personal property loans for manufactured housing. There are several unique things that are involved which have to do with the actual capital that this bill, while I'm sure in the actual gist of the bill and the desire for the bill is to help out the consumer, this would deter future lending in the state of Minnesota. And this, in fact, from what I'm being told by colleagues within the actual investing community, could decimate manufactured housing lending for personal property loans. The situation that we have here is there are uniquenesses that aren't around in the mortgage catastrophe that were created by the mortgage catastrophe. Currently within manufactured housing, there are no ARM loans for this type of loan, the personal property loan. There are no churning of the loans. It doesn't work within the actual guidelines of the investing. There certainly isn't a teaser rate loan that is involved there that created some of the subprime mess that we have here. And so with some of the different things that are out there, and I understand where we're at, and no one likes predatory lending, and I appreciate Senator Marty allowing us the opportunity to work with him on this. We certainly don't advocate it, but there are subtle differences between a mortgage loan for manufactured homes and a chattel loan for manufactured homes. The mortgage loan for manufactured homes do fall under all the predatory lending guidelines, but the actual capital markets today require a higher interest rate. If we do subject to the bill as written today, it will price out the lenders that are currently operating within the state of Minnesota. There's approximately five lenders that originate the vast majority of loans here, and those lenders have indicated that it will not be economically feasible for them to do business here. One of the things I'll say before this is, in the past, manufactured housing has changed quite a bit with the lenders that are here. There was a recent study done there. Manufactured housing had their own set of problems in the late 90s. They've cleaned up their act. Currently, today, you can get a 240-month loan on a chattel piece of property for rates as low as 7.25 with no points. That will go away. When you consider the things that Mark said, I want to actually say again to reiterate his points, it costs more on a per basis transaction to originate a $30,000 loan than it does a $300,000 loan, because certain things have to be done no matter what the size. It costs more to service a $30,000 loan compared to a $300,000 loan because you have to do the same things per loan. So when these things come up and come through, the actual cost is driven up on the rates, and the rates are reflected back to the consumer. If further triggers are kicked in, the rates will either come up higher or they'll price themselves out of the market. And that's what we're very afraid of. We're all for, you know, limiting the actual predatory lending and stopping predatory lending. But this thing, I think, misses the mark, and we very much look forward to working with Senator Marty.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schacht.
Madam Chair, I think I want a couple of things. There's one important factor, though, that manufactured housing has in common with the traditional mortgaged house. It's someone's home, and we're concerned about how quickly they can lose that home compared to the home that I live in. And so I think we can work with this. And I just want you to know, I personally think that we should make some progress here in terms of helping people stay in their home. But I certainly also appreciate and understand what you're saying about availability of money for someone to be able to purchase a home. Because I understand when you tinker with the marketplace too much, you can dry up sources of money, and obviously you're concerned about that. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that this bill be re-referred without recommendation to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, and we'll continue to work. And Senator Marty's a member of that committee, and we do similar kinds of work, wordsmithing. We don't have a Senator Higgins, but, you know, we try. And I think we can make some progress here because I want us to do that. So if I may make that motion, Madam Chair.
And Senator Higgins?
And Madam Chair, I have an amendment that's in process to fix some language in here, so
it's maybe a good idea. That's right.
It's the amendment that right. You and I were talking about. So I don't know how long we'll be. Maybe Ms. Pontius can tell us if it's a 5-minute thing or whether I should just give it to Senator Scheid and she can fix it in Commerce when the time comes.
I think we could fix it.
Senator Scheid.
Is this it?
Oh, this is technical.
Oh, this is really technical, this one.
This would not be me.
Madam Chair, I think we should, if we can wait. I mean, I've never seen such a technical amendment. It's just changing numbers, although it is deleting a section. And I don't, is it an author's amendment? Is it? Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid withdraws her motion. Let's,
yes, I do.
And let's put on the author's amendment, because it's a technical amendment, right? Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author would like it to be in.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, it's a good day when we delete things that say the definition of Commissioner of Commerce is the Commissioner of Commerce.
Although, Madam Chair, just
Senator Betzel,
on that point, I mean, we do want to know which commissioner we're talking about, the DNR, but I do notice on page 8, they also refer on page line 18,
they refer to the Commissioner of Commerce. So you don't, if you either put in the definition or the text, you don't need it in both places. Mm-hmm. So I guess if it's in the text, you don't need to put it somewhere else. So.
Is there another amendment floating about Senator Marty or Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, it's on page 3, the top of page 3, the second notice of default. And I gave the language to Ms. Pontius, but it's in process. But what we have here is a really jumbled up sentence. And the amendment that we're waiting for edits it.
Let's have Ms. Pontius read the language of the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, and it would be on page 3, line two, after serve, insert the second notice of default. And then on line 3, before if, insert
upon
the debtor, comma, and then strike the comma at the end there. That's after debtor, because that will become the end of the sentence. And then on lines 14 and 15, delete that last clause of the sentence up to the period. So delete by personally serving upon the debtor the second notice of default.
Is that it, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, that's it.
Ms. Pontius, why don't you read all of the language on subdivision 2, just so that we know exactly what it is we're looking at.
Madam Chair, do you want how it will read with the amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So it'll read, a secured party must personally serve the second notice of default upon the occupant of the manufactured home and, comma, upon, let's see.
I just lost it.
Yes. And, comma, upon the debtor, comma, if the occupant is not the debtor, then it'll be period.
Period.
And then the language on lines 14 and 15 at the end of the sentence is deleted.
Subject, verb, predicate.
Close.
Any discussions? Senator Higgins?
Delete the comma before the word upon.
Right.
That's all.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, just that I know that this subdivision will continue to be discussed. This just clarifies the language that Senator Marty would like. And so just so members understand that. And I think that we need to do that to clean that language up. But we will be discussing this.
The substance of it will be discussed.
Yes.
Right. Senator Marty,
at least
are you open to that?
Right.
All right. On Senator Higgins' motion, as stated by counsel, with some latitude to make sure that we do capture the accurate language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senator,
I renew my motion.
Senator Scheid removes her motion that the Senate Judiciary Committee referred Senate File 2917 to the Committee on Commerce without recommendation. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Marty. And members, after the Commerce Committee has had an opportunity to look at this, and Senator Scheid is a member of this committee, so she'll share with us if it is her sense that there are judiciary issues raised in that in the changes that we need to look at, or if we somehow bypass judiciary issues in this pass, we'll bring it back so that everyone can have a chance to look at it.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
And Madam Chair, Senator Olson is also on that committee, so
we have two points of view there.
So.
Why, Senator Betzel, there is a committee that you're not a member of?
Egg.
But next year always.
Well, we can take
gives another opportunity,
right.
Doesn't it?
They always have a good breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Hey, all I know is I got excited when Senator Pearsall got added to this committee because I know we're going to get good treats.
Treats?
Treats? What?
She thinks I'm going to bring donuts.
She knits stuff.
You know, Senator Pearsall, I am disappointed though. I mean, today is a Friday. And I was kind of thinking, oh, but we went too late last night, yes. I bet.
She's so. Thinking of your health.
Senate file the
2908,
Senator Higgins. So just so that I have it right, we have the 2908, the Higgins bill, 2910, and my bill, 2915.
No, don't have that one yet.
Okay. I think we might make it yet. I think we might make it yet.
Slinger, Taylor, Moore.
Madam Chair.
Whichever one you want, Senator Higgins, of those
908
two.
908 was a bill that came out of the renters working group. It generally does these things. It provides more notice rights to tenants who are victims of foreclosure, provides some monetary relief to tenants forced to move because of a foreclosure. Specifically, Section 1 requires the landlords to tell prospective tenants that the property is in foreclosure. No such notice is currently required, and often people will rent a property not knowing that in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 months, they'll be moving on because the property's in foreclosure and great possibility exists that the owner won't redeem the property. The second section waives any penalty for a tenant in a foreclosed property who would withhold the last month's rent. Tenants in this situation are unlikely to get their security deposit back and may have exhausted their ability to get some other sort of rental assistance from the county. So this would provide some financial relief for the tenants. Section 3 would provide the rights of tenants who lease after the sheriff's sale to get a notice to vacate. They are not now entitled to notice based on the 1995 Court of Appeals ruling in Brosco versus Principal Mutual Life Insurance Company. And it extends the notice from 1 month to 2 months. And I have here Mr. Elwood again, who... Madam Chair, I don't know if we've all said thank you enough to Mr. Elwood for marching down the path of working with all of these working groups and trying to get them into bills that we can present here in the legislature. But he did a great amount of work, continues to do a great amount of work. And so I want to put on the record how much we appreciate the work that he's doing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Before you start, though, Senator Higgins, do you have an amendment that you want to put on the bill?
Madam Chair, we have the amendment with no number on it.
SC-2908.
That one. dash one, we can amend it. And there's some really old language in here talking about atonement and something atoning.
Atonement.
I'll be darned if I know what that means to, but but according to the amendment, it means become the tenant of and that. So this is putting it into modern-day language, and I appreciate Ms. Pontius making
that?
This amendment for us.
Senator Higgins moves the SCS-2908-1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Elwood for further comments, and I'm sure he'll answer questions way better than I could.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, and thank you, Senator Higgins, for those kind words, although given all the wordsmithing that you all have to do, I'm not sure if you're praising me or or not. So, but given that, Senator Higgins eloquently walked through the bill. I think it's pretty clear what it does. I just want to add that these provisions again, were consensus items of all the members of the rental working group, which included landlords in the guise of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And these provisions have been worked on very carefully in concert with that organization. And I, again, want to commend Jack Horner and Todd Liljenquist and the association for their cooperation, collegiality in working on these things. These weren't easy, but in the end, I think we all agree that this was in the best interest of all parties. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions on the specifics.
Any questions for Senator Higgins or Mr. Elwood? Anybody in the audience here to testify either for or against the bill? Mr. Horner, you're kosher?
We support this, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
And appreciate the work of Mr. Elwood and the whole committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 2908 is amended.
Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Chair, the next bill I have is 2910. And it provides an expungement for folks who are who would be renting a property that is in foreclosure. Often the lenders will routinely file eviction notices near the end of the redemption period. But it's really unfair to the tenant because the tenant didn't do anything wrong. So this would provide for the expungement of that eviction when it is solely based on the grounds of the foreclosure of the owner, who is not the person living there. It also provides that the tenant can withhold the last month's rent. And
it's a duplication from the other bill. I don't know why that was in here, too.
That one shouldn't be in here again?
I think it can be deleted because we did this in the prior bill for some reason. They put
an amendment to it?
It's the same provision here.
Okay, thanks.
So I might make a motion to delete.
Senator Higgins.
All right, so let's, Madam Chair, let me quickly move to delete Section 2 because it was just in the last bill. So we don't need to do it again. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Higgins, is that included in your A1 author's amendment that we just received?
It's a technical amendment.
No.
Well, it's a technical amendment here. So, all right. Well, let's.
So, Madam Chair, if we delete Section 2, what's that?
It's apparently a technical amendment in this bill.
If we delete Section 2, then that keeps us from having the same provision in two places.
All right.
So let's start with that, deleting Section 2, Madam Chair.
And Senator Higgins' motion, any discussions? Senator Ortman.
No, I'm sorry, not about the motion, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll vote on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I guess we have the A1 amendment, which is grammar, punctuation, and
just changes up.
The A1 amendment is a technical amendment. Any questions? Senator Higgins moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, what is left is the mandatory expungement of the eviction when it is not for anything that the tenant did, but merely because they were living in a house that got foreclosed.
Okay. Mr. Horner? We're going to move to questions from the committee. Any comments on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack Corner, Minnesota Multi Housing Association. We support this and thank everyone for their work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the operation of Subdivision 3B, number 2, which is that if the tenant did not receive a notice to vacate during or prior to the commencement of the eviction case, then they would be entitled to an expungement of the record. Do you anticipate that the tenant will come to court and to say, I didn't get a notice? I mean, I think that puts the court in a difficult position. It would put the court in a position that if anybody claimed that, they would be entitled to an expungement. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, Mr. Horner.
Mr. Horner.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the tenant would eventually, it's envisioned, I believe, would eventually find out through any of the several ways that he has an expungement, or he has an unlawful detainer on his record. Perhaps when he applies for another apartment or at some future time, finds out, perhaps to his horror, that he has this UD or eviction action on his record that perhaps he didn't even know about because he had moved or never actually received the notice. And so he would then have to make a motion, which is a procedure already in place. He would move for the expungement of that UD, and he would have to show that, in fact, he never got the notice and or had moved. And so really the eviction should not have taken place in the first place. So he would make that motion, and the court would then expunge it.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, that's exactly what I'm thinking, is that – but then – anyone, whether they got a notice or not, could come forward and say they didn't get a notice. And these people then would be in the position of trying to prove that they didn't get a notice, which is a negative. So I'm wondering if you've thought about the operation of that provision in a court. How does the court say, well, I don't believe you, if they make the statement that they did? We're also still trying to prove a negative, that I didn't receive a notice. And I think that provision is a little bit more complicated than meets the eye. I understand what the intent is, and I agree with the intent. If they didn't get the notice, they should be entitled to an expungement. I just think that leaves the players in that courtroom in a tough position.
Madam Chair, maybe Senator Horner, maybe the others have thoughts on the topic, too. I certainly agree that it can be difficult to prove a negative. On the other hand, in my knowledge and experience, and I doubt anyone else who has, when people make motions for expungement, very often, very generally, no one shows up to oppose it. If somebody showed up, if the lender showed up for whatever reason, because for whatever reason the lender didn't want the UD, I keep using the old term, the eviction action expunged, the lender might say, well, I gave notice, and here's a copy of it, and here's when I mailed it. Conceivably, that would happen. But I'm guessing that in virtually all cases, if a tenant shows up and says, I never got notice, nobody would oppose that. And so that right. would be the only statement on record, and I presume the judge would see mandatory expungement. This is not optional, as other expungements are, and the judge would probably have no choice, really, but to expunge it.
Ms. Elwood, what is this 504B.285 procedure, subdivision 1?
Madam Chair, under that section of law, the lender is required to provide – we actually changed this provision just in the other bill to move it to 2 months' notice. So now they have to provide 2 months' notice to vacate in a foreclosure situation. So that is the notice that is referred to. So if the tenant doesn't receive the notice, then this would come into play. And to respond to Senator Ortman's concern, this idea was generated during the working group in discussions with Mr. Horner, but by our legal aid attorneys who do these kinds of things on a routine basis. It's most of the time when these happen, it's from folks who are coming to legal aid so I guess that the two responses I have to you would be these. First, the first threshold is for the plaintiff to prove to our attorney that what they're saying is true. So we're not going to go into court and do something that's not true. But the other thing is, I mean, you know, we are talking about testifying in a court of law, and I think our understanding is people are just not going to go in there and say, you know, I mean, this is not an administrative proceeding. I mean, this is a court of law, and we're just assuming that people are going to be truthful. And if they didn't get the notice, and the other situation is they probably wouldn't be able to. This is something. Somebody who is feeling aggrieved because of the unfairness of having an eviction when they didn't get notice to leave. Those are the kinds of people that are going to come forward. I'd like to think that people are just not going to find out about this and say, oh, I can beat the system. So,
and Ms. Elwood, is this intended to deal with the 50% investor properties in Senator Higgins' district where perhaps the owner of the property might be going through the process, but the tenants have no idea what's going on?
Madam Chair, it in any situation where we've got a foreclosure, and whether it's an investor property or simply that it had been a single family where they're leasing the property to a lessor, it really wouldn't matter. But mm-hmm. Because the procedure that's referred to here, the statutory procedure here, applies under all circumstances where there's a lessee.
Any further discussions? Anybody here in the audience here to testify either for or against this bill? Senator Higgins, what's
Madam
your
Chair, I'll move the Senate File 2910 as amended be recommended to pass, and I think it goes to the floor, too.
Yes. On Senator Higgins' motion, any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. We're going to make it. Let's take the last file.
The only one left.
Okay, the next bill on our agenda, the final bill of the day, is Senate File 2915. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to your committee.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that, I believe that there is, an amendment.
In our packet, oh no, we don't. Wrong one.
It's coming.
It's coming. We have an A1 amendment. Just says page 2, lines 1 and 2, reinstate the stricken language.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get my amendment here. I think we had a discussion. And we weren't sure, if you look at the bill, Senate File 2915 does two things. One, it eliminates the cap of the $8,500 on punitive damages. And then on page 2, eliminate the cap. But on lines 15 and 16, I think that we create a criminal penalty here as an additional tool. It was raised that could potentially have some cost implications, and I'm not sure if we've got a definitive answer for that. So that's why I had the A1 amendment prepared, I think, to strike that language.
Senator Shy.
As opposed to Mr. Speaker.
Right. We're having a bad week.
Senator Shy.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, Senator Moore, that would put in then the cap on punitive damages. That would just be current law.
No.
On page 2.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, it would remove, keep the language in the bill that removes the cap in general, but it would reinstate language putting a cap on punitive damage awards against political subdivisions. And then it doesn't do anything to Section 2.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shard.
Mr. Chairman, then there's no amendment on page 1, though.
No, the A1 amendment only strikes, reinstates the stricken language on page 2, lines 1 and 2.
So that's where a political subdivision is the respondent.
We're keeping the cap on political subdivisions.
Right. So Senator Moore, did you want to move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Moore moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that she desires to proceed. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, I know that there are This bill does raise concerns from the business community, and there are employment lawyers who are here. I would like to give them a chance to testify on this. I mean, it's sort of a kind of an all or nothing. I mean, you can't really tweak with this. Part of the reason why we did this was that we took a look at all the statutory provisions out there that deal with punitive damages, and we sort of weighed them from the ones that are lesser to the ones that are more serious, which I believe this falls into the category of the more serious end of the continuum. And we realized that we recognize that lifting the cap would be helpful because this would fall into the more serious end of the continuum. And so Mr. Elwood and Mr. Brown might want to give some additional information to that conclusion, but that was the rationale for why we brought this forward.
Mr. Elwood, did you want to testify first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. The fact of the matter is we can't think of a more egregious act than discrimination. And when we looked at and it certainly has been a factor. I mean, the reason you might say, well, how did this come up in this context? And, of course, discrimination is a factor in all the mortgage problems. It's one of the factor in the predatory lending area. And then the discussion was, well, should we limit this to just kind of mortgage lending kinds of practices? And the group agreed that if we're going to lift the cap, we might as well lift the cap altogether, because it just didn't – we could come up with no rational reason why we should be capping at a very minimal amount, which is $1,000 over what small claims court is, conciliation court. And what kind of signal does that send for the kind of behaviors that we're trying to deter here? Many statutes, other statutes with a lot lesser issues, like actions that a beer wholesaler might do to a beer retailer, there are no statutory caps on the punitive damages, and so what rationale could there be that there should be a cap here? Where there are caps are things like where a landlord fails to provide a security deposit to a tenant within the reasonable amount of statutory time, and if we weigh that against racial and ethnic discrimination, I think it's apples and oranges. And so what we're simply saying in this bill is there is another statute of law, 549.20, which sets the standards for what the court will determine whether or not punitive damages are allowable. In addition, of course, you know that you can't initially plead punitive damages. That has to be a supplemental pleading. So we're not changing in any way the standards that would that a plaintiff would have to meet in order to get punitive damages. We're just suggesting that we can't think of any good reason why we should be sending a signal in Minnesota that it's basically okay to discriminate because the statutory cap is so small.
Members, Ms. Bonis is having the statutory provisions copied right now that we're going to distribute that set forth the procedures in order to get punitive damages. I just have Ms. Pontius a question, and she wasn't quite sure, but Mr. Elwood, do you know of any other place in statute where punitive damages are capped?
Yes.
I don't have my sheet.
Actually, I gave my sheet to the one I know is there are a couple of ones in the landlord-tenant statutes, I believe. They're okay. Fairly minimal, and they're for things like not providing the security deposit in time and those sorts of things. There are a handful of statutes where there are caps, but the vast majority of statutes where punitive damages are permissible are not capped.
Okay. Mr. Brown, did you also wish to testify? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I am here to discuss just Section 2, the criminal penalty. You'll see on page 2 there's a sentence underlined, nothing in this section limits the power of the state to punish any person for conduct which constitutes a crime under any other statute. I guess what I wanted to address here is why do we need that language and why was that particular language chosen? The mortgage fraud statute was passed a short time ago to give prosecutors an extra tool to go after people who are using false or misleading statements during the mortgage lending practice. This is a section that has not yet started to come up because the cases we're prosecuting happened before this statute came up. But our prosecutors, in looking this over, have recognized a potential problem with the statute, and that is this. The penalty for mortgage fraud under this section is capped at 2 years, which for somebody who's relatively low in the mortgage lending process, somebody who's processing these claims and perhaps making false statements, but not themselves benefiting from it in the way that the ringleader might be, that may be okay. But what we've seen is we have used in the past the theft by swindle statutes to go at the people at the top of that food chain, the ones who are organizing mortgage fraud, and to impose significant sanctions against them. What the Minnesota Supreme Court said way back in 1973 is that where there's a specific statute that addresses something, like mortgage fraud, and a more general statute, like theft by swindle, the courts will use the penalties in the more specific statute, in this case a 2-year cap, unless the legislature says otherwise. In 1980, the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at language that's exactly what you have here in the proposal and said, that's the way the legislature tells us that it's okay for prosecutors to use other sections. And there is another section, section, it's in Chapter 80A, which deals with securities fraud. Securities fraud penalties are capped at 5 years. But there is this sentence in that says, you know, if you can go at them for theft by swindle, prosecutors, go for it. And that's the case that the Minnesota Supreme Court said, okay, legislature has told us that that's okay. So what we're really doing here with this language is fixing a problem before it becomes a problem and not waiting until we get a nasty surprise on appeal or a nasty surprise where a judge is dealing with this after the fact and having to come to you later.
I've just been conferring with Mr. Backus. The language at the bottom of page 2, lines 15 and 16, nothing in this section limits the power of the state to punish any person for conduct with constitution. I would have thought the proper term would have been prosecute. I think you should prosecute before you punish. I think that's what we normally do. But Mr. Backus, apparently there's some history here, whether it's good history or bad history, but there's some history here.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Brown was already mentioning that, but yes, it's. I think it's in at least 4 statutes that they base this language on, and it does say punish, so there is at least precedent for it.
Again, maybe bad precedent, but there's precedent. Okay. Any questions? There are people, I know other people want to testify, I believe may have some concerns about the bill, but any questions of the author or the witnesses on the bill so far? If not, Senator Moore, I believe Dave Dietrichs, the Minnesota Chamber, would like to testify, and there may be others as well here, too. So, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you this morning. Did have an opportunity to talk briefly with Senator Moore yesterday and express some of our concerns. The Chamber opposes the portion of this bill that applies to Section 363A.08, which you can see referenced on line 1.9, specifically the removal of the cap for punitive damages, which applies to that section, which is unfair employment practices. We talked with, in addition to some of our members, the Employment Law Council, and we are concerned with eliminating the cap specifically because in talking to some of our employment attorneys on line 1.19, we've been told that this is kind of a unique situation where actual damages can be tripled by the court. And so we've been told that when actual damages in addition to punitive damages are combined, the reason there was a cap on punitive damages in the first place in this statute was to counterbalance the fact that the treble damages could be tripled in certain situations. We're also concerned that unlimited punitive damages could invite lottery ticket litigation against employers and additional expenses. And furthermore, this could be a problem not only for employers but for the courts. And we were told by our employment attorneys that any change in this delicate balance regarding the actual damages and the punitive damages was a delicate process. So it's our contention that, we oppose the removal of the cap and how this applies to Minnesota employers. And thus, just to reiterate, the Chamber and the Employment Law Council both oppose this portion of the bill. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Does anybody have any evidence as to how often this may have been asserted and actually punitive damage awarded? I mean, it does seem to be a rather high standard that in civil actions you have to have clear and convincing evidence, which is quite high, and show a deliberate disregard for the rights or safety of others. That seems to be kind of tough to do, but, you know, in the appropriate cases it might be there. So it's not just something that the courts just can do. But do you have any evidence of, or does anybody know whether or not, you know, this has been done much in the courts for discrimination cases?
No, Mr. Chair,
don't know.
I'm sorry, I don't have that with me.
Sure, okay. Any questions for this witness? Thank you. And we have somebody else here, too.
Yes.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Patricia Beattie, and I'm an officer with the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. Chad Strathman was originally scheduled to testify, and he left because there was some misunderstanding as to what the amended bill would be. I am also here to present the position of MDLA with respect to what the Chamber had just indicated, and that's the removal of the cap on the punitive damages. I'm also a practicing defense attorney in the employment law area, so I might be able to answer that question that you just asked previously.
Sure.
This statute right now is somewhat unique in terms of the type of recovery of damages and punitive damages already allowed in terms of other state statutes and federal litigation dealing with discrimination laws. Not only, as the previous witness testified, do you have unlimited exposure for attorney fees and the treble damages, which is somewhat unique, which the treble damages does go to your initial question or your last question of that witness, and that has to be a finding that there was some sort of egregious conduct. And so that is already a penalty built into the statute, which many states don't have. But one of the more unique things here that hasn't been identified yet is that there's a civil penalty provision already provided that's unlimited, and that allows a penalty can be assessed if there is an egregious conduct here, and that penalty is paid to the state. So those concerns about there being a lot of litigation generated and windfalls to the claimants in these cases with unlimited punitive damages is addressed by the civil penalty, and the legislature's looked at that already and allowed for that. The removal, then, of the $8,500 cap for punitive damages is not needed, and it also provides a great deal more than I think anyone would have contemplated in terms of the effect it would have on litigation under the Human Rights Act. As you know, the Human Rights Act covers all sorts of discriminatory practices, not just in the housing area, but employment, public services, public accommodation, and being forced to litigate the punitive damages part of a civil lawsuit is going to add to the cost of cases, and it's going to put a whole other layer in that's not needed because the statute already has unlimited civil penalties as a punitive mechanism. It has the treble damages, and the $8,500 is simply a symbolic additional, if you will, punitive mark against someone that is engaged in egregious conduct, but they will be penalized by the civil fine as well as the treble damages and the exposure for paying for the full litigation because they are reimbursing attorney fees of the plaintiffs in these cases.
At what point during a lawsuit is, if a punitive damage is being sought,
Yes.
At what point do you do that? Do you have to prove your case first and then litigate the punitive damages? Is it all throughout the case? At what point does it come through?
It will come through at the end. The way the statute's written right now, because punitive damages is allowed as a matter of statute unlike other civil litigation where a party has to go to the court and ask special permission to bring it. Right now it just comes as part of the case. And so you don't have a lot of litigation about that until your case is done and you can see whether or not the conduct is egregious. At that point, particularly if we have this unlimited cap, there's going to be a lot of litigation that would go into is the employer or the defendant in the case able to pay, what is a reasonable amount, and there's all sorts of motion practice then that is built in at the end of the case. And so it would add to the cost and complexity of litigation, not just for housing cases, but for any case brought under the Human Rights Act.
But ultimately, when you get to the end of the case, the judge has to say either the burden seems to have been met or not, and then if the judge says, I think there has been the elements met here, so now let's talk about punitive damages, the judge says, I don't find it here. I may find discrimination, I just don't find that it reaches this level. I mean, at some point, does the judge say, we're going to proceed on punitive damages or not?
Right, and right now, they're also looking at, is there a penalty? Right. Is there treble damages? They're looking at all of those elements, and I think the main point of my testimony is that the punitive mechanisms are already built in. This is not something that's going to serve any real purpose other than to complicate and add on to the cost of litigation and maybe encourage frivolous claims for punitive damages. Because real egregious conduct will be addressed already in the statute.
And Ms. Beattie, I don't know, do we have the spelling of your last name? Could you spell it?
Yeah, it's B as in boy, E-E-T-Y.
Thank you. Okay, any questions with this witness? Mr. Elwood, did you have something you wanted to add to? Okay. Were there any other witnesses or anybody else here who wanted to be heard on this bill? Okay, well, thank you. Okay, discussion. No more?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2915 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
On that motion, is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I have concerns about encouragement of lawsuits, and I also obviously have deep concerns about discriminatory practices. Have you quantified, and maybe you said that early and I kind of was out of the room, I think, when you, no, I wasn't, I was here, but I may have missed it. I think about it. No, I would never. I might have. Have you quantified the kinds of or numbers of cases you've, you know, or give me some examples here? I mean, I think I know, but what is?
Senator Scheid, your question is what kinds of cases?
What are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, you're seeking to,
where will
to
this
redress
pop up?
Some ill.
Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. So I want to know
what kind of cases?
What
kind of cases? What are we aiming at here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I know, I mean, a good example are the fair housing cases that are brought under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Fair housing cases. I know the Legal Aid has a discrimination law project, and this was the idea that came through them, through the committee that we all worked on. And so I think while, of course, it does impact other aspects covered by the Human Rights Act, again, it seemed odd to simply peg it to one type of discrimination and not another. I mean, it came up in the context of the mortgage foreclosure and the housing arena, but once the idea arose, it didn't seem to make any sense to just limit it to that, because discrimination across the board, I mean, if we're going to raise the cap, we should raise the cap, so or eliminate the cap, I mean. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, sure.
Mr. Chairman, I have some concerns about that, but, I mean, the standards,
are high for punitive damages. I mean, you're right. That's pretty strong, clear, and convincing. And deliberate disregard, you have a pretty high level of proof. You have to show that. Maybe it isn't so unreasonable, but I'm kind of curious to know what kind of cases are out there now or what have been. Because I do think treble damages is a stiff penalty, but I'm not going to oppose the bill. At this point, I just have some concern about what we might be unleashing. But
and compensatory damages may or may not amount to a lot of money. We don't know. Punitive damages can. Senator Moore?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, Senator Schott, I'm not I spoke with the individuals from the chamber, and I was not unsympathetic to their concerns, but I did think through sort of the mechanics of the bill. And what ultimately led me to the conclusion that I think we could move forward with this is the line of questioning that Senator Betson went down, which was that, you know, this doesn't, you don't make this decision at the front end. I mean, the additional costs have already been incurred in the process. So when you get to the back end of the case, when the case comes to a conclusion, there ought to have been enough evidence and information established to tell you whether you meet the high bar or not. And in instances where, you know, it's frivolous, I mean, there's a whole set of penalties against sort of these frivolous claims anyways. But I think that we should have a fairly good idea by the time the case comes to conclusion, as Ms. Beattie testified, that we should already have an idea. And I don't think that it would add incrementally that much more or that excessive of attorney's fees or costs to the case, because it is determined at the back end. But I'm willing to, you know, continue to work with you and to think through a little bit. Maybe other information will surface in terms of potential additional added costs that we haven't thought of.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion.
And your motion is to recommend that the bill be passed and go to the floor, is it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Did we resolve the issue whether there's a fiscal cost in Section 2 then, or do we know
there,
that?
There isn't.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, then Senator Moore moves that Senate File 2915 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Are we adjourned?
Mr. Chair, you may adjourn.
Meeting is adjourned.
Woohoo.
You know, I chaired this for 4 years. We only met down here twice, but we both wish you.